Section 3. Senior's Last Hour. One fine morning in the year 1836, Nassau W. Senior, who may be called the bel esprit of English economists, well known alike for his economic science and for his beautiful style, was summoned from Oxford to Manchester to learn in the latter place the political economy that he taught in the former. The manufacturers elected him as their champion, not only against the newly passed Factory Act, but against a still more menacing 10 hours agitation. With their usual practical acuteness, they had found out that the learned professor wanted a good deal of finishing. It was this discovery that caused them to write for him. On his side, the professor has embodied the lecture he received from the Manchester manufacturers in a pamphlet entitled Letters on the Factory Act, as it affects the cotton manufacture, London, 1837. Here we find, amongst others, the following edifying passage. Under the present law, no mill in which persons under 18 years of age are employed can be worked more than 11.5 hours a day, that is, 12 hours for 5 days in the week, and 9 on Saturday. Now the following analysis will show that in a mill so worked, the whole net profit is derived from the last hour. I will suppose a manufacturer to invest £100,000, £80,000 in his mill and machinery, and £20,000 in raw material and wages. The annual return of that mill, supposing the capital to be turned once a year, and gross profits to be 15%, ought to be goods worth £115,000. Of this £115,000, each of the 23 half-hours of work produces 5 1/15ths, or 1/23rd. Of these 23 1/23ths, constituting the whole £115,000, 20, that is to say £100,000 out of the £115,000, simply replace the capital. 1/23rd, or £5,000 out of the £115,000, makes up for the deterioration of the mill and machinery. The remaining 2 1/23rds, that is, the last 2 of the 23 half-hours of every day, produce the net profit of 10%. If, therefore, prices remaining the same, the factory could be kept at work 13 hours instead of 11.5, with an addition of about £2,600 to the circulating capital, the net profit would be more than doubled. On the other hand, if the hours of working were reduced by 1 hour per day, prices remaining the same, the net profit would be destroyed. If they were reduced by 1.5 hours, even the gross profit would be destroyed. Footnote. We let pass such extraordinary notions as are of no importance for our purpose. For instance, the assertion that manufacturers reckon as part of their profit, gross or net, the amount required to make good wear and tear of machinery, or in other words, to replace a part of the capital. So, too, we pass over any question as to the accuracy of his figures. Leonard Horner has shown in A Letter to Mr. Senior, etc., London, 1837, that they are worth no more than so-called analysis. Leonard Horner was one of the Factory Inquiry Commissioners in 1833, and inspector, or rather censor, of factories till 1859. He rendered undying service to the English working class. He carried on a lifelong contest, not only with the embittered manufacturers, but also with the Cabinet, to whom the number of votes given by the masters in the lower house was a matter of far greater importance than the number of hours worked by the hands in the mills. Apart from efforts in principle, Senior's statement is confused. What he really intended to say was this: the manufacturer employs the workman for 11.5 hours, or for 23 half-hours daily. As the working day, so too the working year, may be conceived to consist of 11.5 hours or 23 half-hours, but each multiplied by the number of working days in the year. On this supposition, the 23 half-hours yield an annual product of £115,000. 1 half-hour yields 1/23 of £115,000. 20 half-hours yield 20/23 of £115,000, equals £100,000. That is, they replace no more than the capital advanced. There remain 3 half-hours, which yield 1/23 of £115,000, equals £5,000, or the gross profit. Of these 3 half-hours, 1 yields 1/23 of £115,000, equals £5,000, that is, it makes up for the wear and tear of the machinery. The remaining 2 half-hours, that is, the last hour, yield 2/23 of £115,000, equals £10,000, or the net profit. In the text, Senior converts the last 2/23 of the product into portions of the working day itself. End of footnote. And the professor calls this an analysis. If, giving credence to the outcries of the manufacturers, he believed that the workmen spend the best part of the day in the production, that is, the reproduction of replacement of the value of the buildings, machinery, cotton, coal, etc., then his analysis was superfluous. His answer would simply have been, "Gentlemen, if you work your mills for 10 hours instead of 11.5, then, other things being equal, the daily consumption of cotton, machinery, etc., will decrease in proportion. You gain just as much as you lose. Your workpeople will in future spend 1.5 hours less time in reproducing or replacing the capital that has been advanced." If, on the other hand, he did not believe them without further inquiry, but as being an expert in such matters deemed an analysis necessary, then he ought, in a question that is concerned exclusively with the relations of net profit to the length of the working day, before all things, to have asked the manufacturers to be careful not to lump together machinery, workshops, raw material, and labour, but to be good enough to place the constant capital invested in buildings, machinery, raw material, etc., on one side of the account, and the capital advanced in wages on the other side. If the professor then found that in accordance with the calculation of the manufacturers, the workman reproduced or replaced his wages in 2 half-hours, in that case he should have continued his analysis thus. According to your figures, the workman in the last hour but one produces his wages, and in the last hour, your surplus value or net profit. Now, since in equal periods he produces equal values, the produce of the last hour but one must have the same value as that of the last hour. Further, it is only while he labours that he produces any value at all, and the amount of his labour is measured by his labour time. This, you say, amounts to 11.5 hours a day. He employs one portion of these 11.5 hours in producing or replacing his wages, and the remaining portion in producing your net profit. Beyond this, he does absolutely nothing. But since, on your assumption, his wages and the surplus value he yields are of equal value, it is clear that he produces his wages in 5.75 hours. And your net profit in the other 5.75 hours. Again, since the value of the yarn produced in 2 hours is equal to the sum of the values of his wages and of your net profit, the measure of the value of this yarn must be 11.5 working hours, of which 5.75 hours measure the value of the yarn produced in the last hour but one, and 5.75 the value of the yarn produced in the last hour. We now come to a ticklish point. Therefore, attention! The last working hour but one is, like the first, an ordinary working hour, neither more nor less. How, then, can the spinner produce in 1 hour, in the shape of yarn, a value that embodies 5¾ hours' labour? The truth is that he performs no such miracle. The use value produced by him in 1 hour is a definite quantity of yarn. The value of this yarn is measured by 5¾ working hours, of which 4¾ were, without any assistance from him, previously embodied in the means of production, in the cotton, the machinery, and so on. The remaining 1 hour alone is added by him. Therefore, since his wages are produced in 5¾ hours, and the yarn produced in 1 hour also contains 5¾ hours' work, there is no witchcraft in the result that the value created by his 5¾ hours spinning is equal to the value of the product spun in 1 hour. You are altogether on the wrong track if you think that he loses a single moment of his working day in reproducing or replacing the values of the cotton, the machinery, and so on. On the contrary, it is because his labour converts the cotton and spindles into yarn, because he spins, that the values of the cotton and spindles go over to the yarn of their own accord. This result is owing to the quality of his labour, not to its quantity. It is true he will in 1 hour transfer to the yarn more value in the shape of cotton than he will in 30 minutes, but that is only because in 1 hour he spins up more cotton than in 30 minutes. You see, then, your assertion that the workman produces in the last hour but one the value of his wages, and in the last hour your net profit, amounts to no more than this, that in the yarn produced by him in 2 working hours, whether they are the 2 first or the 2 last hours of the working day, in that yarn there are incorporated 11½ working hours, or just a whole day's work, that is, 2 hours of his own work, and 9½ hours of other people's. And my assertion that in the first 5¾ hours he produces his wages, and in the last 5¾ hours your net profit, amounts only to this, that you pay him for the former, but not for the latter. In speaking of payment of labour, instead of payment of labour power, I only talk in your own slang. Now, gentlemen, if you compare the working time you pay for with that which you do not pay for, you will find that they are to one another as 30 minutes is to 30 minutes. This gives a rate of 100%, and a very pretty percentage it is. Further, there is not the least doubt that if you make your hands toil for 13 hours instead of 11½, and, as may be expected from you, treat the work done in that extra 1½ hour as pure surplus labour, then the latter will be increased from 5¾ hours labour to 7¼ hours labour, and the rate of surplus value from 100% to 126 2/23%, so that you are altogether too sanguine in expecting that by such an addition of 1½ hours to the working day, the rate will rise from 100% to 200% and more. In other words, that it will be more than doubled. On the other hand, man's heart is a wonderful thing, especially when carried in the purse. You take too pessimist a view when you fear that with a reduction of the hours of labour from 11½ to 10, the whole of your net profit will go to the dogs. Not at all. All other conditions remaining the same, the surplus labour will fall from 5¾ hours to 4¾ hours, a period that still gives a very profitable rate of surplus value, namely 82 14/23%. But this dreadful last hour, about which you have invented more stories than have the millenarians about the Day of Judgment, is all bosh. If it goes, it will cost neither you your net profit, nor the boys and girls whom you employ their purity of mind.
Footnote. If, on the one hand, Senior proved that the net profit of the manufacturer, the existence of the English cotton industry, and England's command of the markets of the world depend on the last working hour, on the other hand, Dr. Andrew Ure showed that if children and young persons under 18 years of age, instead of being kept the full 12 hours in the warm and pure moral atmosphere of the factory, are turned out an hour sooner into the heartless and frivolous outer world, they will be deprived, by idleness and vice, of all hope of salvation for their souls. Since 1848, the factory inspectors have never tired of twitting the masters with this fatal hour. Thus, Mr. Hovell, in his report of the 21st of May 1855, had the following ingenious calculation, he quotes Senior, been correct, every cotton factory in the United Kingdom would have been working at a loss since the year 1850. Reports of the Inspector of Factories for the half-year ending the 30th of April 1855. In the year 1848, after the passing of the 10 Hours Bill, the masters of some flax spinning mills, scattered few and far between over the country on the borders of Dorset and Somerset, foisted a petition against the bill onto the shoulders of a few of their workpeople. One of the clauses of this petition is as follows. Your petitioners, as parents, conceive that an additional hour of leisure will tend more to demoralize the children than otherwise, believing that idleness is the parent of vice. On this, the factory report of the 31st of October 1848 says, the atmosphere of the flax mills in which the children of these virtuous and tender parents work is so loaded with dust and fibre from the raw material that it is exceptionally unpleasant to stand even 10 minutes in the spinning rooms, for you are unable to do so without the most painful sensation, owing to the eyes, the ears, the nostrils, and mouth being immediately filled by the clouds of flax dust from which there is no escape. The labour itself, owing to the feverish haste of the machinery, demands unceasing application of skill and movement, under the control of a watchfulness that never tires, and it seems somewhat hard to let parents apply the term idling to their own children, who, after allowing for meal times, are fettered for 10 whole hours to such an occupation in such an atmosphere. These children work longer than the labourers in the neighbouring villages. Such cruel talk about idleness and vice ought to be branded as the purest cant and the most shameless hypocrisy. That portion of the public who about 12 years ago were struck by the assurance with which, under the sanction of high authority, it was publicly and most earnestly proclaimed that the whole net profit of the manufacturer flows from the labour of the last hour, and that, therefore, the reduction of the working day by 1 hour would destroy his net profit, that portion of the public, we say, will hardly believe its own eyes, when it now finds that the original discovery of the virtues of the last hour has since been so far improved as to include morals as well as profit. So that, if the duration of the labour of children is reduced to a full 10 hours, their morals, together with the net profits of their employers, will vanish, both being dependent on this fatal hour. This same report then gives some examples of the morality and virtue of these same pure-minded manufacturers, of the tricks, the artifices, the cajoling, the threats, and the falsifications they made use of in order first to compel a few defenceless workmen to sign petitions of such a kind, and then to impose them upon Parliament as the petitions of a whole branch of industry or a whole country. It is highly characteristic of the present status of so-called economic science that neither Senior himself, who, at a later period, to his honour be it said, energetically supported the factory legislation, nor his opponents, from first to last, have ever been able to explain the false conclusions of the original discovery. They appeal to actual experience, but the why and wherefore remains a mystery. End of footnote. Whenever your last hour strikes in earnest, think of the Oxford professor. And now, gentlemen, farewell, and may we meet again in yonder better world, but not before. Senior invented the battle cry of the last hour in 1836. Footnote. Nevertheless, the learned professor was not without some benefit from his journey to Manchester. In Letters on the Factory Act, he makes the whole net gains, including profit and interests, and even something more, depend upon a single unpaid hour's work of the labourer. 1 year previously, in his Outlines of Political Economy, written for the instruction of Oxford students and cultivated Philistines, he had also discovered, in opposition to Ricardo's determination of value by labour, that profit is derived from the labour of the capitalist, and interest from his asceticism, in other words, from his abstinence. The dodge was an old one, but the word abstinence was new. Herr Rocher translates it rightly by enthaltung. Some of his countrymen, the Browns, Jones, and Robinsons of Germany, not so well versed in Latin as he, have, monk-like, rendered it by entsagung, renunciation. End of footnote. In the London Economist of the 15th of April, 1848, the same cry was again raised by James Wilson, an economic mandarin of high standing, this time in opposition to the 10 hours bill. Section 4. Surplus Produce. The portion of the product that represents the surplus value, 1/10 of the £20 or 2 pounds of yarn, in the example given in Section 2, we call surplus produce. Just as the rate of surplus value is determined by its relation not to the sum total of the capital, but to its variable part, in like manner the relative quantity of surplus produce is determined by the ratio that this produce bears, not to the remaining part of the total product, but to that part of it in which is incorporated the necessary labour. Since the production of surplus value is the chief end and aim of capitalist production, it is clear that the greatness of a man's or a nation's wealth should be measured not by the absolute quantity produced, but by the relative magnitude of the surplus produce. Footnote. To an individual with a capital of £20,000, whose profits were £2,000 per annum, it would be a matter quite indifferent whether his capital would employ 100 or 1,000 men, whether the commodity produced sold for £10,000 or £20,000, provided, in all cases, his profit were not diminished below £2,000. Is not the real interest of the nation similar? Provided its net real income, its rent and profits, be the same, it is of no importance whether the nation consists of 10 or of 12 millions of inhabitants. Ricardo. Long before Ricardo, Arthur Young, a fanatical upholder of surplus produce, for the rest a rambling, uncritical writer, whose reputation is in the inverse ratio of his merit, says, "Of what use in a modern kingdom would be a whole province thus divided, in the old Roman manner, by small independent peasants, however well cultivated, except for the mere purpose of breeding men, which, taken singly, is a most useless purpose?" Arthur Young, Political Arithmetic, etc., 1774. Very curious is the strong inclination to represent net wealth as beneficial to the labouring class, though it is evidently not, on account of being net. T. Hopkins, On Rent of Land, etc., 1828. End of footnote. The sum of the necessary labour and the surplus labour, that is, of the periods of time during which the workman replaces the value of his labour power and produces the surplus value, this sum constitutes the actual time during which he works, that is, the working day.